Hi, I'm Mark. I'm an alcoholic. I forgot my tie. I'm 49 years old. I've been sober for 15 years. My sobriety date is July 10th of 95. And it's great to be here tonight. I know that John told me, and I'm not sure I'm supposed to share this, so sorry if I'm not supposed to share this, but he told me that I'm in this special group now, that any future meetings after tonight's that I come to, that I get free coffee. So I couldn't pass on that. I grew up in San Gabriel Valley, small town, Hacienda Heights, and I was a good student, and I had a wonderful family, two younger brothers, great parents, and I say great parents. My dad had a drinking trouble. He, in his lifetime, he had 16 DUIs, and I know that sounds like a lot, but I always look back, I think his first three probably were less expensive than running a stop sign right now, so it was easy on him at the start, but he was very successful in business, and people loved him, so it didn't give me an impression that his DUIs were all that negative. I remember when I was about 10 years old, every year we would have this Christmas show that the family would get together and do. And, you know, the mom and dad would drink with the aunts and uncles, and by the time the Christmas show was happening, they were ready for the show. And it was like a Saturday Night Live, where we would do some Christmas songs, and then we would do some little comedy. And we did this one commercial that was kind of a spoof on an old commercial at the time, the Cross Your Heart bra, how it lifts and separates. And we did a commercial on the Cross Your Balls jock. And when we did that, we were shocked at the reply that we got from our drunk parents. And it was like, at the time, it didn't make me suddenly want to drink, but it did put the thought into my mind that, you know, when I get to that age, that's going to make me have more fun than we're having right now. And by the time I was 16, that was when I got my first job, and I was a cook for a restaurant in Whittier. It was a combo of Coco's and Reuben's. And that was a big change, because suddenly I'm working with people that are all going to the local colleges. And some of the guys that I was with and some of the waitresses that worked, we would go out and go to their campus and have some party time after work. And that would happen more than sometimes. And that gave me a picture of how much I was missing out in high school. By the time I was a senior in high school, grades were really taking a dive. And they were down to C's. I had to work hard to get C's. And when I was doing that, it was funny. Just last year, I went to my 30-year reunion for high school. And a lot of people were asking me questions about this thing that I used to do at parties, and it kind of drove me nuts that they kept asking, because I didn't want to hear about it. But they were asking, because when it would get late at the party and they were passing around a hat to try to collect some money to go for another beer run, I would try to get them to pitch in a little more money by telling them that, you know, put some more in and I'll eat the light bulb right out of that lamp. And they would go, yeah, right. And so sure enough, as soon as that hat got finished passed around and it reached the level that we were after, that's what I'd do. I'd put the little small end in and bite it, and then I'd just eat it like potato chips. And you know, the reason I tell that is because when I was, before I was drinking, I was a shy guy. And then all of a sudden when I was drinking, I would do anything for attention. And by the time I was 18 and getting started with college, I moved down here to San Diego and was going to San Diego State, and that brought in a higher level of partying and more consistency. I suddenly wasn't living at home and had anybody to answer to. And when I partied a lot then, I remember Mom would always ask me questions. And I always found it easier to simply tell the truth, because I didn't want to have to keep track of whatever lies I was thinking of telling. So I figured eventually she's going to be afraid to keep asking. And so it was one night she's asking me, how many beers did you have? And I said, I just had one. And she said, no, I'm serious. How many beers did you have? And I said, I swear to God, Mom, I just had one beer. And she said, all right, never mind. I don't want to talk with you. And I looked at her and I said, Mom, I swear all night I just had Budweiser. And, you know, I thought it was funny at the time, and she didn't laugh at all. About that time, I got a summer job at this bank. And every Friday, I always remember there was these two guys that would come in, and they would be coming after work on Friday afternoon to deposit their checks. And they had a couple of beers in their laps, and I worked as a drive-up teller. And back then, there was no camera on me, so I could say what I wanted and do what I want. And so I was joking with them about how mean that was to sit there and just bring those beers and drink in front of me like that. And sure enough, what did they do? Every Friday now, they would send a beer in the tube. Every Friday. And the great thing was, I'm sitting next, there's no camera, I'm also sitting next to this storage closet, so I would just take it and keep it in there. And it worked out great. And that was about the time where I started worrying, not about me, but I start worrying about Dad. And I would stop on the way home from whatever I was out doing and take a look to see if his car was in there at the Sunset Room. That was the local dive that was Dad's favorite. And when I would see his car in there, I would go in and just order a Coke. I was 18 at the time. And when I was doing that, the whole idea was that I was going to be there and try to give him a ride home. And you know that doesn't work. But I kept trying. And sometimes he would follow me home, and that's about as far as it got. But one of the nights, I'm sitting in there, and I had just gotten there, and there was a new waitress. And she comes up, and she looks at me, and she says, I'm sorry, what were you having? Was it Budweiser? I said, yeah, that's what I was having. And so all of a sudden, I'm 18 years old, and where I'm just going to stop and help Dad, I'm getting served. And I figure that was good, right? And I'm going to help him about his drinking troubles, and suddenly I'm getting served there. And the big thing that changed was when I'm going home, where I usually would look for his car, I wouldn't look for his car anymore, because I figure he's going to come eventually. So I would just go in and sit down and have a few, and that's how that went. So that's when my drinking really took an incline. And I was 20 years old when something came into my life that I wasn't familiar with. I started having seizures. And I didn't know much about epilepsy. But the docs did some testing, and they found a tumor. And it was actually in a good area, so it was simple to remove. It was a brain tumor. But they took that out. And, you know, when I started having seizures, I lost my driver's license. And, you know, I'm sure there's a few of you who have gone through losing your driver's license. But I tell you, when it's for a medical reason, there was no guarantee at all that I would ever get that license back. So when the docs were telling me not to drink, I didn't drink. And I went for 90 days without drinking while they were trying all their meds. I need a drink. And when I got to about 70 days, that's when, you know, I would have two or three seizures a week. And when I got to 70 days, I would have a seizure, and I wasn't angry anymore, because all of a sudden I was taking it as a positive, because, hey, this is proven that the alcohol has nothing to do with it. So for the last 20 days, it was good that the seizures would happen. After 90 days, I just went right back to my old habits. And, you know, somehow I since I didn't have a license, couldn't get to school, so I started working. And I didn't, once I got the license back, the company that I was working for, they asked me to stick with them. And they moved me to the San Diego office, and I came down, and I had gotten my license back, and I moved to San Diego. It was an easy decision, moving from L.A. to San Diego. I had a sales position. I was a sales engineer, so suddenly I was entertaining clients. I did business trips out to Chicago and late nights with the guys at Rush Street and an expense account that covered all my drinking and golf that I wanted to cover, and I loved it. And so when I was about 24, things were going great. Sales numbers were big. New car, bought a nice three-bedroom condo on a golf course, and I played early morning golf with the guys. And, you know, early morning golf on a Saturday where I need to get up at 6, the alarm would go off, but I wouldn't wake up. And it would go off for maybe 10 minutes before my neighbors started knocking on the wall. And so that would wake me up, and for whatever reason, and I would head out and go play golf. And when I was heading to the course, I would be drinking a couple of Budweisers, and then I'd have two more that I'd carry with me to the first tee. And that was because the guys had a nickname for me. My nickname was Shakes. And it was like, if my hands were shaking, that club head down there near the ball is really moving. So that was my reason for my early morning drinking. And, you know, there was a guy that I was part of our group, who you probably are familiar with, a lot of you, Charlie Joyner, and I was playing with him, and he didn't drink much, but he had a lot of friends that gave him a lot of booze. And he one day he's saying, "Mark, why don't you come over after we finish, and I got a bunch of stuff to give you." And so that was a great friendship I had. And so soon after that, things were going great, I thought, and then seizure happened again, totaled the car. It wasn't because I wasn't taking meds, it just things weren't working, and I lost my driver's license again. I wanted to keep my position as a sales engineer, so I rented a room out and hired a driver to take me around on sales calls, and I made that work. And, you know, the thinking nowadays goes into the fact that the surgery that I ended up having to get control of the seizures, they went in and removed the majority of my left temporal lobe, the area surrounding the focal point, because they couldn't get control with meds. And today I need to always wonder, if I had gone by what they said and not done my drinking, would the meds have worked, and I didn't need that. So it gives you an idea why I keep some notes up front. But I got over that surgery, and I started doing some public speaking for United Way and the Epilepsy Foundation and in a big fundraising campaign that they have every year. And to hide my shakes, I didn't want to take attention away from what I was talking about. I would have a few drinks on the way, just like golf. And believe it or not, at the end of the year, they took me out to Washington, D.C. for a national award that they gave me. And that was proof to me that I don't have a problem. That was just another example of what was going right in life that proved that I didn't have anything to worry about in my drinking. So I get my driver's license back after a couple of years, and I took a big increase on my bad habits. I would go to meet somebody at golf course, and I would spend the night there because I knew I wasn't going to wake up to the alarm. And I'd leave a note in the pro shop. I'd slide it in the mail slot with a $5 bill on it to say thank you, telling me to wake me up at about 6:45. And they would come out to my car and wake me up. And I was just to find out I was at the wrong course. And so the city amateur I was in one year, I was in first after the first day. After the second day, I fell back to second place after the third day. And I overslept and was late for my tee time and DQ'd. And that's the type of thing that was going on. When I knew, usually I didn't know that I drank too much, but when I did know, it was because I'd be sitting there and I would light up back when you could smoke in the bar, I'd go light up a cigarette, and when I go to put it in the ashtray, there's one that's just lit a second ago. And when that would happen, I would decide that I'm not going to drive home. So instead of driving home, I would drive to my office. It was closer. And so I'd sleep in the office. And unfortunately, I didn't just do that on weekends. And they'd come in the morning, and you know, my door would be shut, but you could hear me and certainly could smell snoring in there, all my drinking breath. And so they opened the doors and everything. But what was amazing looking back on that is that my company, they were, my home office knew about it. But as long as I'm not getting in trouble with the law and as long as my sales numbers are there, I never got trouble at all for drinking. And so lots of that. But when I got close to my bottom, there were certain things that went wrong all at the same time. And one of them, the biggest, was my dad's 60th birthday. He got his final 502, and he was going to have to go spend some time. And he wouldn't accept that, so he took his own life. And, you know, that was another step or excuse, whatever you want to call it, to take me to a higher level of my drinking. And, you know, a friend at the time, I remember, gave me the Serenity Prayer. And it was somebody from that I got to know from United Way. And I asked her later, it was kind of funny, after I had about 5 years of sobriety, I gave her a call and said, you know, when you gave that to me, I didn't really know that you knew I was an alcoholic. She said, what? And so then I had to tell the story. And yeah, she just gave it because somebody gave it to her once, and it meant a lot. And you know, there's a lot of things I misunderstood. But it was beautiful. But at the same time, the thing that I remember the most is that I was solely focused on accepting the things I couldn't change. When I had that, and I kept it for a couple of years, and I gave it back to her. But that was the only part that I was reading. And there was a family reunion cruise. One more mom story. And there was a family reunion cruise, and Dad had already left, so I'm sharing a room with Mom. And I get in at 3 o'clock or whatever time it was, and I go into the room without turning the lights on. I don't want to wake her up. So I get into my bed and crash out, and she wakes me at about 10:30 in the morning, something like that, and tells me we're supposed to meet for brunch with the family. And I sit up in bed and I go, okay, and I look down and there's all this brown shit all over me, and I don't know what to think. And I look down and I realized what happened. Put my finger in it, and I laugh. It was a chocolate bar that they left on the bed, and and I was laughing, but Mom wasn't laughing. That was another. And so that's how things were. That there was my last golf trip that I took over to Ireland. Something happened on the second day of a 2-week trip where we got home back to where we were staying at 5 a.m. And rather than go to bed, I better check the plumbing. And I was going to go over to the men's room, and I didn't want to wake anybody up. So I'm going out in the dark, and I turned the wrong way out of my room, and my toe hits the post that holds up the banister, and my weight goes forward over the I land on the bottom 3 stairs, and so everybody else is awake but me. And I broke this bone in my hand, and there was no more golf for that trip. And, you know, I love golf, but for whatever reason, it didn't really bother me, because I'll get home and play some golf, and I'm going to go have some fun getting to know all the locals during the day while my guys are playing golf. And that's the attitude I had. And I get home from that trip, and the first thing that happened was I'm on a host committee for ASHRAE, the American Society of Heating, Refrigeration, and Air Conditioning Engineers. And we had a dinner dance this one night, and I come driving up to the hotel where we're having that, and sure enough, there's a sign that says committee member parking. And so I'm in a coat and tie and have my committee badge, and I park in there, and I see a sign, committee entrance for committee members only. And I go walking in there, and it didn't look like the right place, because I'm dressed nice, and there's like peanut shells all over the floor, and there's park benches. And I go walking up, and the first guy I run into, I said, I'm not sure if I'm in the right place. And he said, are you here for the AA International Convention? I stepped back and I said, no, sorry, I didn't mean to bother you. And I said, take care. And I went to turn around, and he goes, that's all right, I'll see you another time. You know, and I'll never forget that. I didn't put much meaning to it, but, you know, less than a week later, I'm visiting my brother, who's in town for the International. And I remember when I was really looking forward, I had my cast on, and I was looking forward to telling him the story about my hand. And I won't forget about how I was telling him the story about what happened, and I said how lucky I was that I was drunk, or I could have gotten hurt really bad. And that's kind of what he did. He laughed at me, and I, you know, I got serious. I said, "No, I'm serious." And he goes, "Mark, if you weren't drunk, would it have happened?" I never thought of it that way. So that really bothered me, because all of a sudden I didn't know what to say. And it was quiet for a sec. And as the evening went on, we went out after dinner to the concert that was outdoors, and just walking along to get out there, everybody was so friendly and the atmosphere was lovely. And I didn't know that that's what, I had no idea what to expect, but it was great to be around. But the time came where Dean said that, you know, I got to get to my meeting, so would you like to join me? And I said, well, no, thanks. I'll stay out of your way on that, and I'll see you tomorrow. And so I headed out and stopped it. And that was the first time when I was sitting at the pub that pint was in front of me, and I'm thinking that I drink too much. And that was the first time, because all of a sudden certain thoughts are all mixing together. And less than a week later, you know, when my dad, since it was on his 60th birthday, had that last 502, since then I promised myself that I would never drink on my birthday. And less than a week later, my birthday, you know it, I drank. And the next morning I was very angry, and I knew that I needed to get control of my drinking. And so I called AA and found a meeting, and sure enough, it was a Monday men's meeting, and I went to that to learn how to control my drinking. And I was shocked at how I cried when I was trying to share, and you know, I didn't really understand why. And looking back on that, that's something that brings the importance of the third tradition to me. And the part of the long form says our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism. Hence, we may refuse none who wish to recover. And that meant a lot, not at the time, but looking back, it was a closed meeting that they let me stay on, because I wasn't calling myself an alcoholic. I just was there because I drank too much. Figure that. And so that meant a lot. And I went to a Tuesday meeting, didn't know what to expect. And I look forward to this beginners meeting I had on Wednesday. And, you know, when they asked how many newcomers, how many hands raised? Yeah, just me. And I didn't understand that. I thought it was supposed to be a beginners meeting, and I'm the only one. And so part of the sharing in that was big, because when the sharing was, I don't remember the topic, but there was a lot of different people that were talking about the shakes. And so all of a sudden, my nickname that I liked, the golfer buddies calling me, I didn't like that. And so I started realizing how much I could relate with, and how many things that applied to me that I heard in meetings. And that was when I knew, that third meeting was when I knew that when I was introducing myself as an alcoholic that I meant it. And I remember talking with my brother right after that, because I would go to Epilepsy Foundation meetings, and nobody with epilepsy really wants to be called an epileptic. I'm a person with epilepsy. And I'm telling him that, and he goes, "Okay, Mark, you're a person who's an alcoholic." So we both kind of laughed, and for whatever reason, that got me past worrying about calling myself an alcoholic. And soon after that, I was talking with an old-timer, and this is somebody that I wish I could remember who it was, because he's somebody that I never got to thank. But when I was talking with him after the meeting, I was telling how, yeah, there's a lot that I can relate with when I'm hearing the sharing at the meetings, but, you know, there's a lot that's way to a higher, different level. You know, my problem isn't that bad. And, you know, so he looked at me and he said, "Mark, you need to focus on what you can relate with and ignore the rest. Don't look for the exceptions." And for whatever reason, I didn't argue with him on it, and I started doing it that way. And when I started going to meetings, I got a whole lot more out of it. And that meant a lot. That's why I missed out on thanking him. So wherever you are, thank you. But when I was less than 30 days, I had a business trip out to New Orleans. And when I went out for that, it was planned about 6 months prior. So, you know, business, I figure I haven't put priorities in the right order yet, so I'm still going on this trip. And it was to go to the Jazz Festival in New Orleans, and that is a drinking atmosphere. And when I went out there, I hosted dinner the first night, and, you know, in talking with the people at the table, it was a bunch of engineers that I did things with and their wives that came along and husbands, and everybody was drinking but me. But I just told them that I take medicine for the seizures and I can't drink with it. Okay, maybe I've been doing that for 20 years and I still drank, but that's what I was using. And it worked fine in keeping me from feeling that I needed to drink with the business associates and stuff. But what was more important was that after dinner finished up, that I said that I needed to go meet up with some friends that I had locally, and that I'll see you guys tomorrow. And so I went to a local meeting. And when I went to that meeting and introduced myself as a newcomer, and they knew I was from far away, there was plenty of people that were helping out and talking with me after that. And, you know, for where I was and for 3 or 4 days in a place like that, that was really important. I ended up going having coffee for quite a while, a few coffees, with a couple of the guys from the meeting. And even though I was wrong for going on that trip, that helped me get through it. So I get back home, and you know, at my start, I can't ignore the negatives. The negatives, you probably have an idea already, but, you know, I thought I knew what I needed. I had no sponsor for over a year, so obviously with no sponsor, I was not working the steps, and I held back from sharing at meetings. I wasn't comfortable, whatever my excuse was. I also tried to keep the same friends. I remember every once in a while my brother would kind of ask me, you know, so you're having a lot of new friends now, and I'm going, no, what do you mean? You know, because I was trying to just go to meetings and keep the same life, just without drinking. And, you know, when I got to a point where I'd be getting up early in the morning to go to work, and I'd be shaving my face, and I'm not quite awake yet, but I'm in front of the mirror, and all of a sudden I realize that I drank the night before. And all of a sudden I start crying, and I'm angry, and I don't know what to do, what to think. By the time I finish shaving, I'm realizing that I had a drunk dream. And, you know, the drunk dreams happened pretty often for a while, and I hated it at the time. But when I look back now, I'm really actually grateful that they happened, because it still was at a point where I didn't have a sponsor. I wasn't working the program. I was going to meetings. But, you know, that was something that helped me. And when I was about 4 months sober, I went to that beginner's meeting, and the normal coffee maker had fallen out and wasn't part of the program and wasn't coming to meetings. And the secretary looked over and said, Mark, are you interested in becoming coffee maker for us? And I didn't think much of it. I said, sure, I'll do that. And, you know, when I said yes to that, I had no idea just how much that was going to mean, because when I would go to meetings, it was going right at the time it started, which means a couple minutes after probably, and then at the end of the meeting, I'm out of there. And all of a sudden, I'm coming early to make the coffee. I'm having conversations with people that I thought I knew, but now I'm really getting to know. And it was fabulous, the difference. And then after cleaning up after the meeting, I'm starting to go out for coffee with friends after. By the time I was 6 months sober, I was secretary for a couple of meetings. So that was a huge starting point. And I got to say that when last month I got my 15-year token, the secretary of that meeting was who I asked to come to the beginners meeting and give me that token, because that was, I'll always remember that. The positives really started, and, you know, when the positives started, I was being consistent with meetings. I had a good variance. I had my men's meeting. I had a 12 and 12 big book, an as-bill sees it, and a speaker meeting, because the speaker meetings to me were much easier to get things out of, because, you know, like I tried to tell you, I have trouble with memory. So while a meeting's going on that I know that I might be picked next to share, I'm hearing some of what's being said, and I'm thinking more about what I'm going to say. And so I'm not, it was better off for me as a newcomer when I would get picked early, because then after that, I got to really listen. And so that's why I also like to have the speakers meeting. And all of a sudden, of all things, Irish music started sounding different. I would hear the same songs. I've always loved it, but there was, as a matter of fact, I sing a song at my home group, on my AA birthday, and as well as St. Patrick's Day, and I have fun with that. But the songs that meant something different, examples were, there was a song called Casey, and it was about an Irish bishop who had a drinking problem, and it was sounded like a funny song, and it went on. And after sobriety started, I did some reading online and found out that it was a true story and it was serious. And there was a song, Feel So Different. And she starts it out by saying the Serenity Prayer and then just getting into her own story. And I'd heard it so many times before that, but I had no idea what the meaning of anything that was being said in that song was. But of all things, the one that when we were in the pubs, that everybody would be loud singing and smiling and joking about, was a song called Delirium Tremens. Go figure. And, you know, that's one that when I found out that he was serious about what he was saying, that got my attention on a whole lot of things. When I got to my first birthday, I was proud. I mean, I had my brother, I asked my brother to come down from L.A. to give me my token, because it was that special to me. And that was just after that I got a sponsor and started working the steps. And there was the first guy that ever came and asked me to be his sponsor was at the Sunday night meeting that was shortly after my first, once I got to a year. And when he came to ask me, I didn't know what to say. I mean, we had a great conversation, and I said, you know what, I'd love to, but I was honest and said, I haven't sponsored yet, so I'm going to need to talk with my sponsor, and I'll see you here next week. And so I go and talk to my sponsor, and sure enough, it was my sponsor's sponsor at the meeting who sent the guy towards me. So my grand sponsor was who sent him over. So I go the next week to that meeting really looking forward, and unfortunately, I never saw him again. And that part was sad, but the great part for me was that all of a sudden it was just another step that I felt better about, that I was being told that I could help somebody else maybe. And it was about the time of my second birthday that I was talking with friends right after I got my second token, and you know, they were being pretty honest with me, because you know, without the sponsor the first year, my sharing was all pretty negative. Negative about me. And when we were talking after I got my second token, they were being open and honest in telling me, Mark, after you got your token last year, we didn't think we'd see you here this year. And that was a beautiful thing for me to hear, because it wasn't negative at all. It was telling me how much that I had changed and had gotten better at taking part. And it was about that time that I ran into some friends at a Christmas party. It was a business-related Christmas party, a dinner dance. And, you know, she wanted to dance with her husband, and it was a friend, Bridget, that's actually here tonight. But she wanted to dance with her husband, and you know, he didn't want to dance, and he was important to me in business. And so I grabbed her hand and said, "Come on, Bridget, you know, I figure I'll save John." And so we danced a few, and after that, she looks at me and she says, "Mark, where's your date?" And I said, "Oh, I'm not dating right now, and I don't, you know, no, I don't have anybody that I wanted to bring to a business function." She says, "Can I set you up on a blind date?" And, you know, normally it was an easy, no thanks, you know, I'm not interested. John was more important, though. So I kept a smile on my face and said, "Yeah, I'd love to." And so sure enough, we get set up. I have a blind date that happened a little while after that. And it was a lunch where we met at a place called Shakespeare's down near the airport. And the funny thing, we sit down for lunch, and I'm looking over, and she's got a ginger ale. That's what it was. And so I felt good about that, because it was a kind of a pub restaurant. And I ordered a Coke, and the waitress heads out to go get my Coke, and my date's looking at me going, "But they have so many imports on tap, and it's Friday." And so I'm going, "Yeah, but I got to get back to the office, and, you know, so thanks, but not today." And she starts saying something again, and I look down, and her keychain's on the table, and her token's hanging from it. And so I'm going, "Okay, what if I have one? Will you have one with me?" And, you know, and so I didn't do that for very long. I just did it to get her back for doing it to me. But so I told her that I was in program, and I showed her my token, and it was really shocking how suddenly conversation just flowed, and we could talk about anything. And, you know, if she was up here right now, she would tell you that it was only 2 months till I asked her to marry me. And it was actually 2.5. And so we got married 12 years ago. And that was over in Ireland, where she was born and raised. And we had, at that time, we had two separate engagement parties, because we still had two separate groups of friends. And it made perfect sense not to try to mix the party. And that worked really well. And something else that was funny is, after we were married for 3 years, we're visiting some friends on the East Coast. And when we're at their house, he shows a video of his college graduation party that was like 5 years before. And we had only been married for 2 or 3 years. And there's Claire and I, excuse me, her name's Claire, we're dancing at this party. We thought we had never met. We meet at a blind date, and we didn't recognize each other. But that's how it was. It was fortunate that we didn't remember each other, probably. So today we have a nice house. We have a wonderful home, and a very lovely young boy, Kyle, who's 8 years old. And life is spoiling me. And, you know, I learned here that if I really want to help myself, that I need to take action. And meetings, whether before, during, or after, but taking part in meetings and talking with my sponsor. And I need to take care of myself first. And I remember when somebody told me a good example of that, about how when you're always trying to ignore the flight attendant at the beginning of flight, and they're telling you to put the oxygen mask on yourself before helping somebody else. It's similar to that. You need to take care of yourself first. And I like that. So it's kind of, there's funny little things like that that when I'm somewhere else remind me of what I'm grateful for in sobriety. There was some friends that we went to see that movie 28 Days. And I'll always remember how we were sitting there, and there's a couple rows back, some people that you can hear bottles clanging. And through this movie, you know, it wasn't so much that it was a great movie, but the fact that we were laughing at completely different parts that they were. that made me come to realize how much my thinking had changed. And I like that a great deal, so I had to share that. And, you know, today I can say that I have serenity in the face of adversity. I have a blood cancer called multiple myeloma. And when that came on, that was about 7 years ago that the doc told me about that. And I didn't know, I'd never heard of it. Didn't know anything about it. And let me mention it, it really hasn't taken an incline. We're just keeping track, so I'm not going through any treatments or anything. But when that first came in, all of a sudden, the stress in my thinking about what I was afraid of took a big jump, and I doubled meetings. I mean, that brought me a place where I had plenty of people I could talk with. There was plenty that I could share with, and there was also MM group meetings. But I got to tell you, that's a good reminder to me of how important our 10th tradition is, of no opinion on outside issues, because those meetings would go so far, and then all of a sudden there's big arguments on comments that were political or church connected. And, you know, now I have a new set of friends and priorities. I make time for meetings. There was plenty of time for drinking. You've heard that. Business trips and vacations, that's part of the planning, is looking for what meetings I'm going to go to. Last trip that we took was to the International, so I hope a lot of you got to go enjoy that. That was outstanding. That I got to admit, though, that was the first time ever that I had to take a ride in the back of a police car. And before you think too many negative thoughts about me, we went to a fireworks show, and it was so crowded with people that our cab couldn't get back to us to come pick us up. And we're waiting at this intersection trying to figure out how we're going to get back when the police are finished running this intersection and traffic's lightning. They saw our name tags and knew we were there for the AA convention. And guy, he comes up and he says, "Look, you're in a bad part of town. Can I give you a ride to your hotel?" So that's why I was in the back of this. There was about 6 years ago that I was asked to lead a meeting in Ireland, and it was fun to do, and I don't remember how well I did in the meeting, but I remember that people were just being lovely in coming up and thanking me afterwards, and I was standing there with my wife, and there was this beautiful young lady that came up, and she just looks at me and tells me that she just loves my accent. And my wife's hand is grabbing my hand a little harder, and she hears that all the time, so I didn't really feel bad about it. So. But the big thing about that was it was about two nights later that, you know, suddenly I'm not used to all the tea and the caffeine that I'm taking in while I'm over there with her and her family, and I can't sleep. So I get up and I grab this orange soda that I had in the fridge, and I go outside and sit down, and I take a swig of the orange soda, and we're staying with her sister, and I just went, "Oh my God, she mixed something into this soda." And I hadn't had a bad dream for at least 4 years. I hadn't had a temptation to drink for that long or longer. And all of a sudden, my mind is going, "All right, when I finish this, where does she keep it and what does she have?" That's how quick my thinking went. And next thought, I called my sponsor. And his question to me was, "Did you have any more?" And, you know, how I said, "No, that's what I'm calling you for." And he said, "Well, Mark, this is something that you just need to learn from. It doesn't break your sobriety, but you know that there are times that you need to be careful." And it was a couple of days later that we're out at a store, and I knew I wasn't going to leave it in the fridge, so I grab an orange soda, and I open it up and have a swig, and it was the same taste. Her sister never put anything in that. It was just an Irish orange soda doesn't taste the same. So what do you? I almost lose my sobriety because my thinking went that crazy. And so if I lost my sobriety, I know that I could come back, but that doesn't mean that I would. And that is what brings back the importance of that meeting I went to two nights before I had that orange soda. That I can take vacation from work and not from program. And I'd like to finish up with a quote. I believe this is from Chuck C. Action gets you into right thinking. Thinking doesn't get you into right action.